Kjenner du noen som snart har bursdag? Med morgenlevering kan du sende bursdagsfrokosten helt hjem til noen du glad I. Enten det partneren din, en god venn eller et familiemedlem. Gjør dagen ekstra spesiell for en du bryr deg om. Med frokost, blomster og sjokolade. Levert hjem på den store dagen. Fordi en god bursdag starter med en ekstra god frokost. Se hvor enkelt det å gi noen en minnerik bursdagsmorgen på morgenlevering.no.
En podcast fra Podplay.
Ready? You have the cameras rolling. He was hosting boozy parties in Downing Street.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
I have a dream.
We will win this election and we will change the country together.
Even war as rules. We must demand that all parties uphold and respect their obligations under international humanitarian law.
Welcome. My name is Eirik Bergesen. I am without Sofie Høgestøl today. However, this is still our very personal attempt at looking behind the news of the week, trying to find different angles to say something about the future, looking for the big picture the way we see it. Every Friday. This, however, is not a Friday. This is a few days after Friday. We're recording this on a Friday. And the reason we are doing this bonus episode is that I am here with Richard Gowan. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So you are UN Director of the International Crisis Group. And you, we've had two episodes in English. You were the first. And you are now back again. And the reason you're back again is obviously that you know a lot about what's going on in the world when it comes to international crises. Because since we talked last time, obviously a lot of things have happened. And I'm very eager to hear your viewpoint. You're very close to UN. And you're, in fact, here in Oslo for a conference with the International Crisis Group. You'll be meeting later this morning. To sit down and talk about all these things. Obviously a lot to talk about when you deal with international crises.
I mean, yes, this has been a really dreadful year in many parts of the world. I mean, not only has the war in Ukraine ground on without any clear conclusion, but we have seen very serious violence in Sudan. We have seen very serious violence between Armenia and Azerbaijan over Nagorno-Karabakh. But just as Crisis Group is coming to Oslo and we're holding our board meeting in Oslo, obviously we are all focused primarily on the situation in the Middle East. And I think there is a real sense amongst anyone who works on crisis management and international diplomacy that the war between Israel and Hamas is not just one more spike of violence in the Middle East. It is something out of the ordinary, and it's going to have major long-term repercussions for the region and maybe also for global politics. So Crisis Group brings our board together twice a year. Our board members are former ambassadors, former ministers. We will be focusing on the whole range of problems in the world. We'll be talking about coups in Africa. We'll be talking about North Korea's nuclear program. I'm leading a session on the UN, but I think we all recognize that Israel and the Palestinians are going to be at the center of our discussions.
We all together, there's some 100 conflicts and wars going on in the world these days.
It depends how you count, but I think that's a pretty good estimate. And it's also true that the number of people being killed in these wars has really surged over the last couple of years. Obviously, the death toll in Ukraine has been very significant. The death toll in Gaza is now rising quite fast. But we've also seen conflicts in places like Ethiopia claiming hundreds of thousands of lives. We don't really know how many people have died in some recent major wars in Africa, but the figures are awfully high. You know, I've been working on crisis and conflict for 20 years, and I think that there is a, you know, there is a deep sense amongst sort of my colleagues, our community, that we are entering a new phase in international conflict where the number of wars and the number of people dying is rising, you know, at a very significant rate. So it's a very concerning time.
Recent figures show that, yeah, this is increasing. The number of deaths are increasing. The number of conflicts are increasing. They're lasting longer. And also the UN, which you follow closely, do not seem to be able to solve or even stall conflicts. We know that Norway has been unsuccessful in our peace diplomacy recently. We see that the U.S. as well are struggling and certainly have been struggling with their peace efforts in the Middle East for a long time. We'll see. We'll talk more about how they are trying to involve themselves in this very crisis these days. The whole idea of trying to maintain or trying to find peace through negotiations, through diplomacy, that's not very promising these days. How do you look upon that?
You know, it isn't very surprising that we're seeing this downturn in peacemaking. And I would absolutely agree. It does seem that mediation efforts, peacekeeping operations are struggling in many cases. But we do have to remember that, you know, a lot of our peacemaking tools developed in the wake of the Cold War. We've had 30 years of, you know, an unusual level of international cooperation, and that has meant that bodies like the UN Security Council were, for quite a long time, able to function and work in a pretty constructive way when it came to launching mediation efforts or launching peacekeeping efforts. That post-Cold War moment has passed. I mean, I think it's been eroding for quite some time. You know, we saw the Security Council failing over Syria 10 years ago. But as the West's relationship with Russia has broken down, as tensions with China have risen, the overall international framework for peace and security has become very, very fragile. Now, I think there's a tendency in the media, and it's quite natural, to look at individual conflicts and ask, what is the UN doing? I mean, this is a question which I certainly get asked all the time by journalists, by my family. You know, why is the UN failing? Why is this mediator scrabbling to deal with a conflict? But it's rarely the fault of an individual international official or even the UN as an institution that they can't get a grip on a conflict. Instead, you have broader geopolitical fractures that mean that an organization like the UN just doesn't have the leverage and credibility that it had 15 or 20 years ago. So I'm not trying to pass the buck. We should always be critical of the UN. We should always be critical of NATO and other institutions that are meant to make peace. But we do have to recognize that they are operating in a fundamentally new and fundamentally negative environment.
I also saw a figure that said that, in general terms, a conflict or a war even takes 8 to 11 years to resolve, or maybe even contain. And that this is longer than it used to be. But each new war, we don't see the other war, at least the one that gets media attention, being resolved. So there seems to be more being put on the table. If the UN is not effective, like what are these days the effective tools in a very general sense to gaining peace?
I mean, I would just make one point about the question of war duration. Mm. Back in the 1990s, and I think into the first decade of this century, we did see more mediated peace agreements. But actually, a lot of those agreements were quite shallow, and a lot of the wars restarted again within 5 or 6 years. So even when we thought we were good at mediation and peacekeeping, actually, we were often just sticking a Band-Aid on a conflict, and then it would erupt again once the tension had moved on. I mean, I think what is different now is that there is almost a sense of fatalism about some of these conflicts. I mentioned the absolutely appalling civil war in Ethiopia that lasted from 2020 to 2022. There were diplomatic efforts to resolve that, and the US and others worked behind the scenes to get a ceasefire. But in that case, no one could get a diplomatic grip on the violence, and in essence, it only ended when one side, the Ethiopian government, was winning on the battlefield. So to some extent, wars are now being allowed to burn out, which can look pretty awful. You know, there are alternative peacemakers out there. In Africa in particular, we're seeing the African Union stepping up and leading on diplomacy in places where the UN might once have been the primary peacemaker. The Gulf countries are increasingly getting involved in peacemaking efforts, reflecting their global interests. And, it's been fascinating this year over Ukraine that actually a whole range of non-Western countries have come forward and said, we will try to make peace between Moscow and Kiev. So Brazil has launched a peace initiative. South Africa has launched a peace initiative. They haven't worked. And I think the Ukrainians have found these quite irritating because I think they feel a lot of the self-appointed peacemakers are sympathetic to Moscow. But I find this a sign of the times. It's probably true to say that if you have an image of an international peacemaker, it's a Nordic person.
Yeah.
Probably a Nordic male, backed up by the US. Well, maybe in future that stereotype is going to be a bit less applicable.
Yeah. Fortunately, other actors are there to present diplomatic pathways. But if we stick a little bit with that, what happened to the Nordic peace mediator? Why is this he or she not that relevant anymore?
Well, I don't want to dismiss Nordic diplomacy altogether, and we still see many diplomats from this region working on the ground in regions like the Middle East, with a very high level of skill and dedication. The UN representative for the Israelis and the Palestinians is Norwegian. The UN representative for Syria is Norwegian. The UN representative for Yemen is Swedish. I think Nordic diplomats will continue to have a outsized role in this field for some time to come. But I think what is also true is that as power shifts, as power becomes more diffuse, you are going to see other players stepping up. So one big question we've been talking about for a while is whether China is going to start playing a more significant role in peacemaking. The Chinese are cautious. But we do now see Chinese officials being more active in Africa, in cases like Myanmar, on China's borders. I think we would imagine that over time, just by default, China is going to become a more significant player in peacemaking. And then, you know, we're also seeing countries from other regions taking risks. One conflict that Crisis Group has been following very closely this year is the breakdown of law and order in Haiti. Mm. And traditionally, if you have a crisis in Haiti, you know, the US and Canada go in, UN peacekeepers go in. But this time around, you know, the US doesn't want to send troops. The Canadians looked at the level of violence and said, you know, no thanks. This is too risky. And so who has stepped up to send peacekeepers? Kenya. You know, Kenya, citing solidarity with the people of the Caribbean, is offering to send police to Haiti. That's not something I would have been able to imagine or predict 10 years ago. I mean, it's worth saying we don't know if these experiments are going to work. And frankly, African mediators and Chinese mediators will face all the same problems and all the same setbacks that Finnish or Danish or Norwegians face. But it's just a much more fluid world. And it's a world in which a whole range of new players are getting their hands dirty in peacemaking. Sometimes it will work, sometimes it won't.
Norwegian model, yeah. We talk a lot about here in Norway, and I guess you can expand it to call it a Nordic model for peacekeeping. It has to do with changing governments. We will still have a long-term perspective. There will be significant resources allocated. There's a tight cooperation with academics and government and so on. Sort of, at least in our opinion, we sort of perceive this to not have a hidden agenda. There's no political economic interests that have to do with our national interests. Obviously, with other actors such as Arab states and China, this is not the case. There will be at least be a suspicion of hidden agendas. How does this change the dynamics in peacekeeping?
Look, there's an endless debate amongst academics who work on peacemaking about whether more or less neutral mediators are better and more effective than biased mediators, those who bring interests. I think that if you look over the history of peace processes, it is obvious that there are situations where having a impartial, neutral, patient outside mediator is crucial. I think that, you know, one of the last really successful mediation processes that we know of is that for Colombia, where Norway led talks between the government and the FARC rebel group. And the fact that Norway was willing to invest, you know, time and diplomatic skill in that was crucial, and the fact that Norway was an outsider was, I think, crucial to its credibility. However, it is worth keeping in mind that even there, Norway wasn't working alone. It had the backing of the US. It had the backing of Cuba. Cuba hosted the talks. Venezuela and other Latin American countries were active in the background. And so, yeah, Norway was there being neutral. it was a very impressive effort. But one of the reasons it worked was that you had some political actors closer to Colombia invested in it too. So I think there are situations where bringing in actors with very clear stakes and interests in a conflict can backfire. But it's also necessary to operate in the real world of power, as it were. So, you know, even if you are the purest, most disinterested Nordic mediator possible, you do need to work with those who have influence.
Hmm. Try to force you to make a sweeping sort of generalization here. If you look at it, sort of like the idealist approach versus the more realistic approach, in the sense that there's power involved, economic and political power, and sometimes biased. How do you see this developing?
Look, I think that...
Is there still room for idealism, I think I'm asking.
Is there still room for idealism? I hope there is. I think what I would say is that, as I said before, I think we are entering a period where peacemaking is going to be increasingly diffuse, increasingly weird. But that doesn't mean that a country like Norway can't contribute. I think that there is a general recognition that that Norway, some of its neighbors, have a depth of expertise in this which very few other countries can boast of. And I think over time you will find a whole range of actors continuing to come to Oslo asking for that expertise, asking for that support. I think what has changed is that whereas 15 years ago, Norway's institutional partner of choice would probably have been the UN. Now you're going to find yourself going to Beijing, going to Nairobi, going to Havana, and having to work with a much broader range of partners. So the skills are still useful. I think the skills are still admired. But the world in which a country like Norway has to apply its peacemaking expertise is just a lot more complicated and a lot wilder. So yes, stay Norwegian, stay idealistic, but understand that this is much less now about getting on the SAS flight to New York and talking to UN officials and coming up with a plan. It's going to be much more about working with an unexpected range of partners.
Before we talk more about the current developments and what's going on the ground in Gaza, I'd just like to, if we just go back to sort of like the golden age of at least optimism. I was just in Prague, and I visited the Museum of Communism, and it's a very well designed museum, very interesting both in content and what they displayed, and then sort of follows the progress of communism, idealism behind that as well, and how that quickly deteriorated, and certainly the effect on Czechoslovakia at the time, and then you see all the resistance and the idea based resistance, the liberal thoughts and so on, and how they were knockdown, but how Adaism persisted. And it ends in 1989, which a lot of other things also happened in the world that were good. There was the uprising in Tiananmen Square. You had Nelson Mandela being released and so on. And then you had Václav Havel rising up to become president. The last image as you exit through the gift shop is Havel in Congress with his familiar peace sign. And there's a quote about, which I can't remember now, but something about truth prevailing and sort of always clinging to your ideals, whatever agony you face. And as I said, it ends in 1989. Obviously, history doesn't end then, even though Fukuyama sort of proposed that very fact, that was the end of history. Are there any similarities around the world these days where you, in fact, not just see a peace process ending or being mediated on realpolitik terms, or because China or Arab states are involved? Do you see, this old school democratic processes throughout, decades that ends up in a liberal democratic situation?
I mean, I think we've learned over the last 30 years that while the 1989 moment was astonishing, and I think probably shapes our generation's view of how politics should be, that it's not an easily transferable model to other parts of the world.
No.
I remember back in 2011 when the Arab revolutions were spreading from Tunisia to Egypt to Syria. There were quite a lot of commentators then who were saying, oh, look, this is the Arab world's 1989. Now, wiser heads cautioned, don't get caught up in that emotional response, because I think this is going to turn out very differently. And it did turn out very differently. I mean, it's sad to say that we can't see very many countries going down that positive pathway right now. In fact, what we can see is quite the reverse. We're seeing a shift globally towards autocracy. And there have been some more hopeful cases recently. In 2019, there was a really inspiring democratic uprising in Sudan. And for a few years, it did seem that Sudan might be on the road to civilian rule after, many years of conflict. But tragically, that has fallen apart, and Sudan is now one of the bloodiest places on earth. There are still places where you can see glimmers of hope. We just mentioned Colombia. The Colombian government is now trying to make what it calls total peace with various armed groups and criminal gangs, and I think that that is a positive development. But it's not 1989 anymore. The long 1989 is over. And instead, those of us who care about peace in the first instance, but also care about democracy and human rights, are now, in American football terms, we're playing defense. We are trying to protect countries from sliding into autocracy or war. And we're trying to, as I think you're implying in a lot of your questions, defend a certain set of values which are under a huge amount of pressure. And, you mentioned that I'm here for the International Crisis Group board meeting. Let me assure you that a lot of the questions you are asking about Norway's place in the world, an NGO like the International Crisis Group, which is a global conflict prevention organization that was launched in the mid-1990s, you know, we're asking the same questions of ourselves. How do we keep up the work of peacemaking, of conflict prevention, in a different world?
If we move on to the Middle East, and unfortunately, you mentioned the war in Ethiopia that has the figures vary, but some 600,000 people died within a couple of years. Without the world's media attention being that focused on this undeservingly, we now see a huge media focus on this very conflict, what's going on in Gaza now. Every day outside our parliament, there's a demonstration. We see everything from politicians, NGOs, influencers, young people, people who haven't been engaged in politics before, engaging in this conflict, which would seem as a good first step in getting our political leaders' attention, that people want a resolution, and we both know how difficult that will be here. But sort of, if we just start there, the cry for a better situation in Gaza, a cry for ceasefire, a cry for the parties, both parties, to not just rely on military means, but to have some real talks, to have diplomatic efforts. How do you look upon this situation?
I mean, I think what is striking about this situation is that the public are not being quite as rational as you imply. Rather than simply seeing an outpouring of calls for peace, what you have in many, well, I think in all European countries, in the US, as well, is a cacophony of competing narratives. Mm. And so, yes, many people are calling for a ceasefire, but you have very strong pro-Israel sentiment, you have very strong pro-Palestinian sentiment, and I think we're not hearing a coherent global call for peace. We're actually hearing pretty vicious competing political narratives about what has happened and about who is to blame. It struck me that this is a very different moment to February 2022 when Russia launched its all-out invasion of Ukraine. I mean, then there was, at least in Western countries, a very unified outpouring of sympathy for the Ukrainians. And you know, there was a sort of great effort to help refugees. I mean, that was a moment where society, at least on the surface, seemed united. Now, I think all of our societies are being divided by this war. Mm. A colleague and I were walking through Oslo last night, and you know, there were various protests and counter protests. Now, of course, it's Oslo at 5 p.m. in November, so it was very dark, and so we were sort of squinting, sort of trying to work out, you know, are those guys for Palestine or are those guys against Palestine? Mm. You don't actually know. It's just such a divisive moment. There is something peculiar about the conflict between Israel and Palestinians. It does raise emotions and opinions deep within all of our societies in a way that even a war like that in Ethiopia just does not. And I think that also profoundly complicates our response to what is going on in the Middle East, because it is mediated through these very intense domestic debates, which spring up so quickly.
One of the things that the Americans are telling the Israelis, it seems these days, is that the their global support will not last, that the public opinion is turning against them. I'm sure they know this. So, but how, whatever way you look at public opinion, and I totally agree that I was trying to put a diplomatic spin on this, but it's mixed, and it's not always helping. But there is a demand for something to be done. And how much do you think that public opinion matters to, obviously it matters to Americans, given that there is an election coming up, and you have the Arab American vote in a swing state as Michigan can decide this election, and those polls aren't looking good these days for Biden. How much does public opinion really matter in this conflict? Global public opinion, most specifically?
I think it matters enormously. I think that if you're viewing this from the perspective of the US, and this is still a case, by the way, where certain old rules apply, and the US is very much the, you know, the only mediator that's out there. You're looking firstly at domestic politics. Clearly, you know, Biden has to think about how the Democratic Party and how U.S. voters view the war. But also, I think the U.S. is also concerned about what this war is doing to public opinion worldwide. The U.S. is, if you zoom out, involved in a very long-term contest for hearts and minds with China, all around the world, in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America. And I think Washington has felt quite satisfied over the last year and a half that it has managed to get a lot of non-Western countries to support its position on Ukraine. And it values that support in part because of the Ukrainian situation, but I think it also sees it sees its efforts to build a coalition in support of Ukraine as part of a broader effort to maintain leadership in the world as an alternative to China. Now we see a large number of a large majority of non-Western states splitting with the US over the Middle East. And I think that US officials are very, very concerned that one long-term beneficiary of that process will be Beijing. Because although the focus right now is on Gaza, this war is feeding into global discussions of how the how the U.S. doesn't care about Arab lives, how the U.S. has double standards about which civilians matter. And at the end of the day, that all favors the main competitor to Washington, which is China.
It also benefits Russia and Iran, what's going on now. How much does that matter?
The Russians are certainly doing everything they can to exploit this moment. My base is New York. My primary focus is the Security Council, and it is very striking that at the UN, the Russians have seized on this war as a an opportunity to put pressure on the US in the way that the US has been putting pressure on Russia over Ukraine since the beginning of last year. So Russian diplomats have been out and about accusing the US of double standards. The Russian ambassador in the Security Council claimed that Lockheed Martin was fueling the war support defense spending. I think that Moscow is reveling in this moment. I mean, I would actually say that at the UN, this is backfiring a bit for the Russians. I think Arab diplomats can see that Moscow is instrumentalizing the crisis. A lot of non-Western countries that are very sympathetic to the Palestinians find Russia's tactics distasteful. But, you know, it simply does play to Russia's advantage when the news is not about Russia vetoing a resolution on Ukraine, but is instead about the US vetoing a resolution on humanitarian assistance to Gaza. So I think Moscow does see this as a real opportunity to disrupt global narratives. And actually, the Russians are much more active about this than the Chinese. I think that China is more wary of throwing itself into diplomatic controversies. As to Iran, I mean, this is probably something that we'll be discussing at the crisis group meeting over the next couple of days. This isn't necessarily a great moment for Iran, because for the time being, it has been possible to contain the conflict between Israel and Hamas. But if the conflict grinds on, or if it gets even more bloody, there is a significant risk that it will escalate regionally, that it will draw in Hezbollah in Lebanon. And it doesn't take very long before you're drawing in the US and Iran in a pretty real way into this conflict. All the indications are that Hezbollah and Iran don't want that. They want to keep this contained. They're probably nervous about this getting out of control. So I don't think we should assume that Iran is entirely happy with this this moment in the way that Russia does seem to be.
Strangely, you see that while the Western world came together on the Ukraine issue and are somewhat divided when it comes to Israel-Palestine, you see the U.S. opposite. They are now, this morning, this is Friday, we woke up to the news that the House of Representatives had passed a bill which gave aid to Israel, but not to Ukraine. So, which is the obvious result of there finally being a Republican speaker, and that Mike Johnson is that seems to be his approach. We'll see if that continues. But this is also obviously will have some effect somehow. How do you see the U.S. Moving forward now on both issues, but most specifically on when it comes to support for Ukraine?
I mean, I think the U.S. approach to the Middle East is still fairly clear. On the one hand, the U.S. will continue to provide a huge amount of support to the Israelis. But the Biden administration is obviously focused on avoiding regional escalation. And actually, we do see Biden and Secretary of State Blinken pressing the need for humanitarian pauses in the conflict. I think the U.S. is trying to keep this war in a box. But at the end of the day, the US will always support Israel. And that's, I think that's a given. What is happening to US support for Ukraine is much harder to read. I don't think the US is going to simply stop giving support to the Ukrainians. There's a lot of political posturing now. Most of us are just trying to find out who Mike Johnson is. He has sent mixed messages over his attitudes to Ukraine. But I think that more generally, the war in the Middle East has exploded at a very, very difficult moment for the Ukrainians. I think the Ukrainian chief of staff said in an interview this week, I think with The Economist, the war is at a stalemate. The counteroffensive, which was such a focus for the whole year, has not delivered what Kiev and Kiev's supporters had hoped. There are quite a lot of signs that in both the US and in parts of Europe, governments are starting to ask questions about how long they can keep up their current level of support to the Ukrainians. And so on top of that, you suddenly have international attention being diverted to the Middle East. I mean, there have been quite a lot of signs that Zelensky is concerned about this. I mean, Zelensky tried to go to Israel very soon after the 7 October attacks. The Israelis turned him down. He would evidently like to draw a clear line between the two wars. Biden has tried to draw a clear line between the two wars, but I don't think that's working at the moment. So we're suddenly in a very, very uncertain moment regarding Ukraine. What I would say is that there is one man who can immediately ratchet up sympathy for the Ukrainians again, and that is Vladimir Putin. And if, as everyone now predicts, Russia is preparing for a pretty brutal bombardment of Ukrainian civilian infrastructure over the winter, I think that will shift the narrative again. I think that, especially if the war in Gaza does come to a pause, attention will return to Ukraine, and people will see that Russia is continuing to use very brutal tactics. And that will probably shake up some political calculations, and that will mean that governments will look for more funds to support the Ukrainians. So it may be that this moment of uncertainty is temporary. Right now, if you're looking at this from the Ukrainian perspective, it's a very uneasy moment.
Do you see a situation where there's not enough development? It seems to be positive developments all along for the Ukrainians on the battlefield, but stops more and more, and the international community led by the US sees that we now have to resolve this somehow. We need peace talks. We need to find a way out of this. And you mentioned the idea of war burning out, and maybe in the sense that we see that Congress is not able to justify this towards voters, maybe on both sides of the aisle, even, we don't have to go into specifics of what that would look like, a peace agreement. But is there a possibility of a peace agreement at all, given the fact that this has sort of entered a sort of a stage of a stalemate?
I mean, I would say, just to start with, that I think the Biden administration had always been hoping that the war would be winding down about now. I mean, we did hear that at the end of last year and the beginning of this year, when the US was, you know, pumping arms into Ukraine, that US officials were still telling their Ukrainian counterparts that they should understand that this level of support was not indefinite. And that's partially for technical reasons. I mean, there are just limitations to the amount of armaments that the US and its allies can give Kiev. But, you know, I think there was also a political understanding that President Biden did not want to be going into the 2024 elections with a burning war in Europe as a distraction. Now, obviously, what the US was hoping for was that the counteroffensive would deliver some big wins and that it would be possible to start some sort of peace diplomacy with Ukraine in a clearly stronger position. Now, instead, we are in a much more opaque moment. I think the real obstacle to peace talks is, very frankly, that there is no real sign that Russia wants to engage in good faith discussions. And, you know, all the way through this year, even when things have been going pretty badly for Russian forces, as in the endless siege of Bakhmut, you know, Putin and his outriders have, you know, continued to insist that Ukraine has to accept very harsh peace terms. Given the current geopolitical situation, I don't think Putin is going to become any more lenient. In fact, I think he probably sort of sees that it's in his interest to drag the war out. As one crisis group board member said to me yesterday, Putin has some Trump cards, and one of them is Trump. Ultimately, he may just conclude that it's better to drag on the conflict in the hope that we get Trump 2.0 next year, and then the Ukrainian political position will be fundamentally undermined. So for these reasons, I don't see a peace process. What I think we might see is sometime next year, a de facto freezing of the conflict. I mean, both sides have absorbed enormous, I mean, horrible losses. It may be that the front lines will stabilize, and you could have almost an undeclared armistice emerging in Ukraine. That's certainly something that I understand, for example, officials in Brussels are talking about behind the scenes. So it may be that we get a very significant reduction in violence without any sort of political framework on top of it.
So by armistice, you mean sort of an agreement by the opposing sides to stop fighting for a certain time?
Well, and, you know, an armistice is a military agreement to stop fighting without a political solution. Mm. And you can have a formal armistice, which is what we've had on the Korean Peninsula since the 1950s. Or you can have just a de facto freezing of the conflict. Now, the Ukrainians, I think, quite rightly, are suspicious of this, because between 2014 and 2022, you know, they had a quasi-frozen conflict in the east of the country. And the Ukrainians would argue that, you know, the West ignored that conflict for too long, and that created the conditions for Putin to risk the 2022 offensive. I think it would be true to say that, you know, even if the war petered out next year, both sides would be looking ahead and imagining a new war sooner rather than later. But it is possible. And I know this is merely me speculating, I should say. This is not a crisis group official position. It is possible that you will see a significant reduction of violence, just because both sides are tired.
Hmm. You mentioned that China are weary in getting involved. Obviously, some people are afraid that China will use this political vacuum to do something when it comes to Taiwan. How do you see that issue?
This is something which Crisis Group has been focusing on a lot recently. We just published a big report on Taiwan. Actually, you can find it on Crisis Group's website. I mean, I think our analysis continues to be that the immediate risks of a hot war remain relatively low. But it is clear that you do have some risks of miscalculation, and also, you know, tensions over Taiwan are doing deep damage to US-China relations more generally. So it is a big source of concern. However, I think, I mean, let's hope that I'm not proved wrong between the time of recording and the time of the podcast coming out, but I think that some of the analysis about Beijing seeing an opening is probably overstated. What is true is that, you know, while the world's attention has been focused on Gaza, we have seen more friction, for example, in the South China Sea between China and the Philippines. This moment when the world is focused on the Middle East certainly is an opportunity for China to make moves to strengthen its regional position. But I don't think we would go as far as saying that Beijing's next step is an all-out war.
Is that because they at the end of the day cherish the global stability too much? Or enough?
It's not fundamentally in China's interest to bring the global economic system crashing down. Yep. And I think there are some tentative signs that the US and the Chinese are tiptoeing towards a shared understanding of this. Mm. It's still not certain, but there is a reasonable possibility that President Biden and Xi Jinping will meet in San Francisco before the end of the year. Interestingly, the US and China seem to be having some talks on nuclear security, which has always been a very sensitive issue between them. I saw that Janet Yellen, you know, the US economic czar, who has always seemed quite dovish on China, was out in the media again the other day, you know, talking about the dangers of the two countries decoupling economically. It's going to be a cold piece. It's going to be a rocky piece, but ultimately, I don't believe that senior policymakers in either Beijing or Washington really want a war. Now, that said, if you go to Washington, it is remarkable how many pundits and think tankers talk about a war with China as something that is inevitably going to happen in the next 10 years. I mean, that's sort of a talking point which has become very common in the US, but I imagine if you'd gone to Washington in the 1970s or early 1980s, you would have found lots of pundits who treated it as automatic that there would be a war with the USSR. I think that sometimes people like me who sit in conference rooms are very good at making these grand statements. People who actually make policy can be a bit more cautious.
Hmm. Maybe even in 88, they were saying this.
I mean, remember there were people in 89 who thought that Glasnost and Perestroika were a trick, and the Soviets would come roaring back. So I mean, that's a good reminder that all these predictions tend to be a little off the boil.
Well, that was at least somewhat reassuring, and I do hope that within the few days before we broadcast this, that will not happen. And
it maybe call me back if there's a world war.
Yeah. Well, hang around and also a few days longer, please. But to end this long and interesting talk that we could have gone on forever, because again there are some around 100, however you way you measure it, conflicts going on these days, and you'll be dealing with a lot of them in your board meeting. But one of the things that definitely is happening right now very dramatically and rapidly is the developments on the ground in Gaza. Which we, as we speak, do not know the status quo of within a couple of days. However, what do you see as plausible developments between Israel and Hamas, Palestinian authorities, moving forward now? I know this is a very broad and very difficult question, Richard. I apologize, but I know that our listeners are very interested in hearing your viewpoints on this.
Look, anything I say will probably be proved wrong by the time this goes live. Mm-hmm. It will certainly be proved wrong in a week or so. I mean, I'm just coughing to buy time before answering that.
I saw through that one.
Ah, damn. Look, it is possible for Israel to keep up its military operation against Hamas. And I'm sure that Israel will be able to count off more senior Hamas leaders killed. But I do think, as we were discussing, that the US is concerned about what this means in terms of global public opinion. And I think there's also a deep concern about the risks of regional escalation. And although, as we were discussing, Iran and Hezbollah don't want a regional escalation, I think everyone recognizes that there will come a certain point when Hezbollah in particular will just have no choice but to enter the conflict if it's grinding on. You know, that could be because the number of fatalities in Gaza reaches a certain high. It could be because there's some especially awful incident in Gaza, but at some point Hezbollah will have to react. I think the focus for the US and the focus for everyone is trying to stop the war before you reach that escalation moment. If we reach that escalation moment, then everything blows up, all the diplomacy so far blows up, and we're in a much, much worse world. I don't think anyone rules out the possibility that we will topple over that cliff. We've got to hope that we don't. What is left if you do get a cessation of hostilities without an escalation? I mean, you will have Israeli troops in Gaza. Even if Hamas is severely degraded militarily, it may well be empowered politically, because, you know, you will have a huge part of the population that has suffered and is being radicalized by what they're seeing. There are various options out there, you know, being leaked to the media. There is an idea that primarily Arab countries, such as Egypt and Morocco, or maybe some other Muslim countries from outside the Arab world, could send peacekeepers. There's even been a hint that the US and Israel have wondered whether you could have a UN administration in Gaza, similar to the UN administration that was set up in Kosovo in 1999. I have to say, talking to people who understand the region much better than me, this sort of internationalization of Gaza doesn't seem very credible. And I don't think if I were a Moroccan or a Indonesian general, I would be very excited by the idea of sending in peacekeepers to Gaza City. I mean, it would be a very risky business. Sadly, what you may end up with is some version of the status quo ante, which is, you know, Gaza being contained by Israel. That would probably mean that Israel would want a bigger buffer zone around Gaza than there was before. It would mean that there would be less opportunities for Palestinians in Gaza to work in Israel. I think the security checks would be very huge. But yeah, sadly, we may just go back to a situation where you still have 2 million people trapped in Gaza, cut off from the rest of the world, because no one can think of a better idea. I mean, I do, you know, you do hear, and maybe this is one of these opportunities for idealism. I do hear people saying that once the smoke clears, this moment could be an opportunity to start real talks again on a two-state solution. I mean, it's 30 years since the Oslo Accords. They're not looking so great right now. But I think if you were rational, you would say that the big lesson, the biggest lesson of this war is that it is time for a macro Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement. Mm. There are, however, real problems with that. One is that on the Palestinian side, the Palestinian leadership, not in Gaza, but of the Palestinian Authority, is weak. It's not necessarily in a position to make a deal. On the Israeli side, I think it's fairly obvious that you're going to have some political turmoil once the war is over. I mean, Netanyahu's position is very fragile. We're not in a position where you have two strong leaders who are able to come together and strike a deal. Mm. But maybe once the conflict settles, and maybe once the politics settles, maybe wiser heads will prevail. And I think, you know, you can always bet on the US making mistakes in the Middle East. I mean, that's one iron law of international relations, which has not changed.
Mm.
But I think there may be officials in Washington who look at this and say, you know, we can't keep on doing this. Because what the US is learning in the course of this crisis is that it doesn't have the ability to manage a war between the Israelis and the Palestinians in the way that it may have done in the 1970s, or it might have done in the 1990s. So it's better to try and get a durable deal now than wait for another war or another couple of wars that the US will find it harder and harder to control.
Yeah, so I think that's my final question. With all these frozen conflicts, this one seems to be one of those that there seems to be a need to resolve somehow. That Israel, the Palestinians, the Americans, and the global public opinion, at least, sort of demands a more concrete solution than just putting a lid on it. So is that the hope for if people didn't understand that before this war, they understand that just kicking the two-state solution bucket down the road, it's not feasible anymore.
Look, I would hope that was the case. Hmm. But will it be politically feasible? That's a different question. But I do think that it's necessary to try.
So Richard, thank you so much for doing this, taking time. I know that you have a busy schedule these days with the board meeting and given the state of the world these days. Every question I've had in my mind, you've been able to answer on your own with the next line as I was thinking about something interesting to ask you. So thanks again for that. You're one of the voices that I follow eagerly to try to put some perspective on what's going on in the world, and you're humble enough to state very clearly that you don't have all the answers, and that the rapid developments in the world these days is very difficult for all of us to comprehend. But if what do you seek of information to enlighten yourself, or maybe even just take your mind off the state of things these days?
Well, if I'm trying to understand what's going on in the world, I'm very lucky to work in an institution like Crisis Group. And maybe we should have said this at the outset. I mean, I represent Crisis Group at the UN. I live in Brooklyn. I go to Manhattan. I talk to diplomats. I have a gin and tonic. I go home. That is fun. But Crisis Group has a lot of colleagues who are based in very tough places, like Kabul. We actually have one colleague who is in Gaza, who's in the middle of the war. And so if I really want to understand the granular realities of a conflict, I go to our website, www.crisisgroup.org, or you can find Crisis Group on Twitter. And obviously I'm going to recommend that, but I would say that I think we as an institution, we don't chase headlines. I think that you'll find that a lot of our reporting deflates some of the crazier analysis that you can find out there on the web. And in a period where, frankly, on social media, discussions of a war like the war between Israel and Hamas is wild and often inaccurate, I think we do offer some accuracy. So please do look at our work. What do I do to take my mind off these dreadful things? Well, the last movie I saw was the Taylor Swift concert movie.
I was actually just about to joke about that.
I saw all 3 hours of it with my kids.
Sophia should have been here to hear this.
Well, yeah, what I discovered after watching 3 hours of Taylor Swift is that I know and like about 6 of her songs. But they came about halfway through, and then I had to watch another hour and a half of songs I neither know or especially like. Not sure my kids massively enjoyed the experience either, but I mean it's a well-made film. I haven't been reading a lot of good fiction recently because work has been so busy. We also had the UN General Assembly in September, but. I find this is sadly not a time where you can get easy distractions. But yeah, if you want to cut yourself off from the world, 3 hours of Taylor Swift is pretty effective.
I might just have to do this. So Sophia, if you're listening, I will now also become a Swifty, as you are, and that the UN director of National Crisis Group seems to be
an agnostic Swifty, if that's possible.
Thank you so much, Richard, for taking the time, and best of luck on your conference and the monitoring and analysis of the international crises of the world.
Thank you very much.
That's enough. Put down the mic.
Du har hørt en podcast fra Podplay. En enklere måte å høre podcast på. Last ned appen Podplay, eller se podplay.no.
Nå lanserer vi i Meny vår nye kundeklubb, Meny Mer. Som Meny Mer-kunde får du mer tromfbonus på nye produkter hver uke. Og 10% tromfbonus på din første handel. Og i hele sommer får du 30% tromfbonus på over 200 produkter fra Jakobs utvalgte. Så bli Meny Mer-kunde i dag og få flere fordeler når du handler hos oss. Meny. Spiser du bedre, lever du bedre.